It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, a male birth control pill could be coming sooner than you think. We'll hear about the latest efforts to develop a hormonal method of birth control and what the remaining obstacles are. First, the United States is a country founded in many respects on ideas. But defining big concepts like equality, liberty, self-interest, freedom, and America's place in the world has always been a messy process. That ongoing conversation has given life in many ways to our culture and politics over the last few centuries. It's also the basis for the field of intellectual history, which our next guest says is a way to eavesdrop on the past. Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison and author of several books. Her latest is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, why tackle the study of history through the lens of ideas?
Spending now my life doing this, I can't imagine any other way of wanting to do it. There are a couple of reasons. One is why most people, I think, are drawn to history is because they're drawn to thinking about how people in the past made sense of themselves, you know, how they made a life for themselves, how they made a world for themselves. And what better way to do that to then, as I say in the book, you know, eavesdrop on how they think about themselves, how they think about their world, how they think about the major problems of the day. So I think it's a way of kind of closing up the distance between us and people in the past and being in a conversation with them.
And speaking of conversation, I hope you don't mind me spoiling the last line of your book. And so the conversation of American thought continues. And that seems like a running theme. It's not just these isolated parade of ideas. It's ideas that cross national boundaries, that cross the boundaries of decades, too. These things keep interacting in new and unexpected ways.
I'm glad you picked up on that last line. The last line of a book is always a hard one, right? Because you want to stick the landing. And it's funny that you pick up on that because the book was provisionally called American Conversations. I think to make the point that American intellectual history, you know, you can talk about it as a tradition, but that makes it sound so formal, so complete, you know, as if it's this artifact that gets handed down from one generation to the next. But that's not how ideas work. That's not how history works. It is an ongoing conversation. People across time, across the expanses, you know, of history, across places, and then, of course, across national boundaries, sometimes linguistic boundaries. And so that is the approach of the book, and I think the approach of intellectual history more broadly is to see how Americans have talked with each other and past each other and sometimes shouted at each other about the things that were most important to them.
And another theme that I think runs through the book is the people who weren't part of the conversation or who were omitted from the conversation sometimes, but were unmistakable parts of it still, from the early interactions of Europeans and Native Americans, from slaves in America, women throughout the history you look at. They weren't not there, but in some ways they were ignored in the main, what we think back on in the main intellectual conversation. Can you talk about the role and the importance of looking at their voices too?
Thank you for noticing that. That was a challenge of the book. It's a challenge of intellectual history in general, because typically intellectual historians look at, you know, sources like books, magazine articles, newspapers, broadsides, sermons. And for much of American history, who got to go on record, of course, were white men, propertied men, which meant that people of different backgrounds, women weren't as easily, you know, traceable on the record. So that is always the challenge of the intellectual historian, is to widen out from those traditional sources to try to listen to the mental, you know, the records of the mental and moral worlds of others. So that was a challenge to do, but they're there. You know, you have people like Judith Sargent Murray, who's an important Revolutionary era thinker, someone like a Frederick Douglass, who was, you know, one of the most important orators of the 19th century. So the records are there. We just have to look for them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen from UW-Madison. Her new book is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. I want to take a whirlwind tour. You cover a lot of ground in the book. Let's start with the first contact between Europeans and Native Americans. As you write about it, and I haven't really thought about it this way, just the existence of Native Americans on this continent led to a lot of reflection about who the Europeans were and the European mm-hmm. settlers in America and how they all fit into the world and the history of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something easy to forget, and partly because the lore that we've inherited through our history, but frankly, some of these European settlers had, which was of a vast open continent, an Eden, or in some cases, a place forsaken by God, where there was not strong enough recognition that there was, in fact, a native populations here and in the hundreds of millions. So for the first 100 years, at least, European settlers and explorers are dwarfed by the Native American population here. And so that's an example, Rob, where you ask me, where do you listen? How do you listen for those silences? Even if we are listening into Puritan era sermons and Native Americans are not mentioned, we as historians know they were there. They were there, right there in the same towns, right on the outskirts. And so kind of looking for the presence of what seem like absences are presences throughout. And so this is any look at early American thought, we have to listen in. Sometimes it's articulated and sometimes it's muffled about what it meant to be a displaced person, whether it was from Germany or France or from the British, somewhere in the British Empire, or even Spain or Portugal, to be landed here on this new continent surrounded by enormous a number of people with a different tongue, different ways, different cultures, and to feel that sense of alienation and estrangement that came as a result of that.
Moving ahead to another challenge, with the revolution predicated on ideas of freedom and liberty and self-determination and equality, and then the contradiction of slavery going on, as you write, actually not just out there, but right at the universities where people were thinking about these things and having to come up with the intellectual framework. And that led some people to abolitionism, saying if we want to be consistent, we have to end slavery. Others saying, no, we're not equal. Here's how we justify this inequality.
Yeah. No, thank you for putting it that way. That's very helpful. And I think something that I tried to do in the book, it's not always easy, but that is, I think there's a temptation for Americans when they think about their past to sort of think about it as a split screen. The North is free and the South, is a slave, or, we've got freedom over here and we've got, some sort of bondage or slavery. And actually the two they're not mutually exclusive. They happen in the same spaces. So you mentioned early American universities. That is something I talk about in the book. Every single early American university is founded on dispossessed land, lands that's dispossessed from Native Americans. Every single American university, in one form or another, has slaves who are building the actual buildings, literally the foundations. Harvard University, it used to be one of the bonuses of becoming the president of Harvard. You had your own personal slave there. We've got examples of students bringing their slaves to school with them. And so right there at the sites of learning, where they're learning, in some cases, the great ideas of the Enlightenment, which is freedom, self-rule, self-determination, is happening in the context, on dispossessed lands in the presence of people who are there in bondage. And many, I would even say a vast majority of these folks are not noticing the dissonance, of those two things. So that's something that I try to focus on the book, not look at slavery and freedom as separate, but how do they work together? I'll give you another example. Thomas Jefferson, one of our most important thinkers about freedom. We can't think about American freedom without thinking about Jefferson, who over the course of his lifetime owned 600 people and had 5 children with his slave. These are not, you have to hold it together, that he's writing Paeans to Liberty while he has an army of slaves serving him. It doesn't discount the work. It doesn't delegitimize it. It just complicates it.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation with UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Which ideas or thinkers do you think have had the biggest impact on America, for better or for worse? Have you seen ideas about things like equality, self-interest, or religion change even in the course of your own lifetime? And are there ideas that you're curious to learn more about? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, reading through your book, one idea that came back to me, and I remember from high school, and I realized almost nothing about it, transcendentalism. This is one of those things that people point to as a key, fundamental American, uniquely American in some ways, school of thought. Mm-hmm. Remind us what that is.
Perhaps it's easy to forget or want to forget because of its unlovely name, transcendentalism. Even the transcendentalists didn't want to be called transcendentalists. So there's a funny, internal dialogue among Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller and others who just thought this was sort of clunky and silly. So the transcendentalists, for those of your listeners who also have a vague recollection from high school, we're typically referring to a group of liberal, very literary intellectuals, mostly around the Boston area in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where many of them, and I mean, the names are Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau is considered in this orbit, pardon me, Herman Melville, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously the biggie is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And they're a group of friends, sometimes frenemies. Some of them are liberal Protestant ministers. Other of them are apostates like an Emerson. But they're all committed to a kind of intellectual project and are working on it together. And that is basically, it comes down to a couple of things. First of all, what the transcendentalists share is a sense that that Americans had achieved their political independence from the old world, but not necessarily an intellectual or a cultural independence. And so what we see with Emerson, and we know it's the self-reliance, right, his big idea of self-reliance and others, was the idea of what would it be like to start an intellectual culture, a set of ideas, a kind of literature that was genuinely organic to our democratic project, genuinely organic to this new world, and not something that we're just inheriting, sort of secondhand from Europe. The second part of it is that what makes the transcendentalists is that they understood that democracy is more than just a political organization, or institution. Democracy would have to also reflect the whole human personality, or in their words, the human soul. So what they're committed to through poetry, through writing, through sermons, through utopias like Brook Farm, was the idea of actually cultivating a democratic personality, a democratic soul.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yes, thank you. This is a fascinating topic, something I've been interested in for many years. I ran for political office in 2008, and in my process of running for the Wisconsin State Legislature, I had a dream about Benjamin Franklin. And I know it's going to sound silly, but I've had a number of dreams in my life about my ancestors and stuff. Well, he came to me and he told me that a Barack Obama was going to be the next president and that this was a great moment for our country. And I asked him, I said, oh, really, why? And he said what you just said about the idea that democracy is a reflection of your soul and philosophy and mm-hmm. community and those kinds of philosophical, mystical aspects of society are really a reflection of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Does his dream version of Ben Franklin match up to the reality?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you, Jeff. First of all, I want to thank you for your service. And second of all, I hope that all of our representatives are as intellectually curious and engaged as you are and also have a space for imagination or what you're calling your dreams. Because to be honest, I think the most magical moments in American history have come when people's dreams of what America could be outshot the reality. One thing I would say to Jeff is that there is a specific history in American political thought about dreams and dreaming. The American dream as an idea. Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Obama, dreams for my father. There's no other political no other politics that I'm aware of, it's certainly not in the Western world, where the language of dreams and dreaming figure so close into our political discourse. And I think that is precisely as what you're touching on, is the sense that there's something larger. What, you know, living a truly democratic life, building a truly democratic society is something that needs to is created through imagination, but also needs to leave some space for that imagination. So I hope that Franklin comes back to you again. He's a good person to visit.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. I want to come to a more modern era now. We hear a lot in the political world about the rise of what people call identity politics, politics based on, say, race, gender, sexuality, things like that. And it's presented as a new thing. Mm-hmm. But looking back at the 19th century, I wonder, is it really so new?
It's I don't want to say it's old wine in new bottles, but it's just a new term for a long-standing, if you will, debate or concern in American life. And I would say, I mean, you mentioned the founding, even before the founding, mm-hmm. when Europeans arrive in this continent, what do they have in common? Nothing. I mean, you know, there are people from Europe who came from different tongues, different religious groups, different classes.
They might well have killed each other if they're in the wrong
country
in Europe.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so what happens already, you know, right from the outset in this American experiment is people trying to figure out what is the we. You know, what holds us together as Americans when we have different faiths and we have different tongues? And so the idea of difference, diversity, questions of inclusion have been there right from the start. And we've addressed these questions differently. We've allowed, you know, some people in and some people out over time. We've redistricted, if you will, the we. But that question about how do we live as one, you know, where do we find our unum out of our pluribus has been with us throughout American history. And identity politics is important and significant, but it's another term for a longstanding problem and possibility, if you will, in a pluralistic America.
I also want to talk about, and coming back to an idea we talked about earlier, the way ideas flow from one place to another. You give an example, I think it's in your introduction, about some of the things that inspired Martin Luther King. There's the Old Testament, but there's mm-hmm. also Gandhi. Can you talk about the international flow of ideas that might lead to a pivotal thinker like Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, that's something, you mentioned it's a brief book, so there's a lot of compression. But that is something I wanted to signal to my readers whenever I had the chance mm-hmm. to, which is sometimes we think of ideas as American, but in fact, they have foreign origins or they crisscross across the globe to become what they are. So the backstory of a Martin Luther King, I mean, this isn't to minimize him. He's singular. He's an irrepeatable miracle in many ways. But Martin Luther King is getting many of his ideas from Gandhi. And Gandhi was an avid reader of Henry David Thoreau and Civil Disobedience. And so that's just one example of the kind of curious crossings, you know, both across space, so geographical crossings, as well as across, you know, expanses of human history that make for what we call this American intellectual tradition or American conversation.
Well, when I think about genius or a great thinker, it isn't necessarily someone who, I don't know how you would come up with ideas out of whole cloth, but it's somebody who takes what's out there and maybe reinvents them, reframes them for the current time.
This you are channeling your inner Ralph Waldo Emerson, because this is precisely Emerson's point about the great genius is actually the most creative reader. So Emerson understood. Emerson is someone who was very, you know, interested in, again, not being derivative, not being secondhand, being his own Adam in history, you know, the first man at history, but understanding that there are intellectual influences coming to him. And so genius, I think, as it's expressed itself in America, is often taking something already there in the Bible, from the Constitution, from Benjamin Franklin, and doing something new with it, you know, reworking it for one's own moment, you know, seeing new possibilities in it. I think a great example, if I may just tuck one in here, is the Declaration of the Sentiment of Rights of Women, 1848. It's modeled on the Declaration of Independence, a time when it was considered, you know, that women could not be free and equal in the way that men could. But in 1848, what do you have but a group of women rewriting the Constitution, or sorry, rewriting the Declaration to declare the independence of women?
In our last minute or so, kind of bringing things home, it seems like another reason to study the history of ideas is these ideas, they're the water we're kind of swimming in, and it's worth it to maybe take these things that we just take for granted and look at the time and place they rose in.
You could not have given a better bumper sticker for intellectual history. So, and this is something I try to talk about in the book. And if there's one thing I hope that readers take away, it's the one thing I hope my students take away is this, that every single conversation we have today, every debate, every conflict, intellectual conflict, everything that we agree on is not necessarily a product of necessity, or, you know, this is not all foreordained. It's a product of history. There's no conversation we're having right now that hasn't in some form or another been wrestled through, struggled through, debated through, you know, in the 1950s, in the 1900s, in the 1850s and earlier. And so to me, that's the great, you know, reward of intellectual history, is that as we wrestle with our post-truth moment, you know, our moment about identity politics, our moment about what's, you know, the state of our very fractured democracy, we can bring ourselves into conversation with some great thinkers and great writers and great advocates and activists from the past who have engaged those same problems in their own time. And sometimes they can help us figure some solutions, but sometimes they just keep us company too. You know, there's a sense of you're part of something larger than yourself. Or we are at this moment because we're going through what many of our forefathers and foremothers have gone through in different form.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of history at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about her new book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest developments in the effort to develop hormonal birth control for men. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.